Pickaxe.
Jetzt nur du, dein Podcast und eine leckere Auszeit. Ab zu Aldi Nord. Für 2,99 € bringst du deine Mittagspause mit Sushi ins Rollen. Lecker. Und für 1,99 € gönnst du dir danach noch eine kleine Eiszeit. Bei Aldi Nord findest du immer das Passende. Klingt gut? Dann probier die Snacktime Sushi Box ab 205 Gramm für nur 2,99 € oder Mucki Sandwich Eis je 8 Stück für nur 1,99 €. Das ist Gutes für alle zum Aldi-Preis. Jetzt in deiner Filiale. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Hi everybody, welcome back to the Triforce Podcast.
Woohoo!
Oh yeah.
Do you like that? Like the big and then the sudden stop?
The yeah. two it people like... excited clapping in the background. Makes it Woo-hoo! Sound.
Woo-hoo!
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So we're back. This time we're not on the road. I'm at home. I'm in my cold ass dad garage. It's cold.
It is cold, Sim.
Yeah, holy shit, is it ever cold?
Oh, God, I hate
man. I hate the cold.
You know what? It's so cold. I drove my wife and my baby daughter somewhere this morning, and it was cold doing that. You know, normally that's not like a cold thing to do. Like if you have to walk somewhere, yeah, you're cold. Or if you're like standing outside, you know, if you're on a construction crew of five people and you work for the government, and you're looking down a manhole all day outside, that's cold.
Or you're having your packed lunch on a girder, you know, suspended above.
That can be pretty cold. It can be pretty windy up there. But normally, you know, you do something like, you know, you drive somebody in somewhere to avoid the weather. But like even inside the car, the steering wheel was so cold, I had to like constantly remove my hands from it while driving.
Okay.
It was that cold.
Safe.
Fuck me.
That sounds safe.
Pretty safe.
Very safe dad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a classic English winter thing. Okay. Yeah,
that's like a dad joke though in itself, isn't it? Like, hey kids, watch this. Woo! You like you know, take your hands off the steering wheel. They're like, Dad, what are you doing? Like, no, it's fine, don't worry.
Yeah, we'll be fine, no, kids.
Just I do remember my dad driving me to school in early, you know, very, very cold winter mornings. You know, and I got a lot of respect for that because it was really cold, really dark when you wake up. You know, you have to get up, you have to get the kids up, get them washed, you know, get them cleaned up, get them some food.
I don't think people appreciate how hard the school run is. And I think that's why, I think in Asia, they get it. They understand that the school run is like really fucking hard work. You got to do it for years and years and years. You become like a hollow shell of a man after it's all said and done. And that's why your kids look after you when you're older in Asia. But over here, they don't. What do? They get government jobs and then they don't give you your pension anymore. And then you're on those commercials where you're frozen to death in your apartment because they didn't put the heating on. You know what I mean? Mm. Like what's up with that? Why can't we take care of old people in Britain like they do in Asia?
Well, in Asia, remember,
they do really well in Asia. Those old people are like looked after super duper well.
Yeah. Well, I don't know I don't know any old people who are not looked after well.
Well, yeah.
To be fair. I mean, I don't know who you're talking about.
How many old
Sips.
People are in your life?
Well, we've got
not many more now. They're all gone.
But there's a few of them gone. I don't know who you're talking about here in that's not being looked after.
I'm talking about those people that you see on documentaries all the damn time. You know, on the news every day, they're like, oh, the price of heating fuel has gone up again. And then they show that crippled old woman who just like looks like nobody ever visits her. And she's got one of those fake fireplaces, you know.
But she was probably a miserable. It's like a heater. She was probably a miserable person in real life, in like when she wasn't an old person. Just because she's now an old person doesn't
mean
you're saying
if she was like a mean old lady, she deserves.
She was probably a mean middle-aged lady, and then she was probably a mean young lady. You know,
I've not
got any sympathy for her. Is what I'm saying.
You're an animal.
Well.
What if her whole extended family died in a plane crash on a vacation? Yeah. Okay.
Well,
invited to.
I'm
awkwardly.
Just saying, I'd like to see some evidence of that, you know, before I'm nice to her. Right?
Evil.
Listen, are you alone and cold, freezing to death because you're a miserable old bitch, or due to extenuating circumstances? Because I need to know that.
Man, go stand outside for 10 minutes, okay, and just wear a cardigan, and that's it, and maybe like a blouse, and come back in and tell me how you feel about this old lady.
What do you mean?
I think you'll feel sorry for her. It's
cold
out
there. What is she doing? She's got no sense at all, standing outside in a cardigan and a blouse in 0 degree What?
She can't afford to put her heat on. It's as cold inside as it is outside. That's what I'm saying. And she's not moving around. She's too old. She's just sitting in a chair, and she's even colder than you because at least you've, like, stood up and gone outside. Like, you know, you got your circulation going. Her circulation isn't going. It doesn't go anymore. That's why she's so cold all the time.
Well, we're not going to have to worry about this problem much longer by the sounds of it, Sips, if she's got that little going for her.
Oh, my God.
She's not able to move around.
Come on.
All right, Adolf, let's not start euthanizing the elderly.
What?
Oh, my goodness.
Is that punishment for not being a nice person? Is that what we're saying now? We're going to kill people?
Listen, so my nan is 90. She's the same age as the Queen. And for her whole life, she has very much modeled herself, had the Queen there as this same age, sort of fashion icon, kind of role model. Right. And so she's a very stout, proactive old lady.
Did you just call your nan stout?
Yeah. She is one of these people who permanently thinks she should be on a diet, you know, even though she's now 90. And so she's constantly, you know, worried about that because I guess she has been her whole life. And so it hasn't changed because she's 90. But this Christmas, you know, we made a decision to put her in a home.
You got her the Kerry Katona exercise DVD.
it's been a very gradual process. It's a bit of... Yeah, okay. It's a very gradual process because she was very independent, wanted to do her own thing. And so we sort of moved her from her bungalow to a smaller sort of flat nearer to us so we could visit more often. And so, you know, we always used to take turns. So when I was there, I would visit my nan like a couple of times a week. And then when I moved away, my brother would do it and pop in and stuff. Anyway, it was a very gradual process. And so eventually she found that she wasn't able to go walking out every day. And so we got someone to push her out in the wheelchair. And then she wasn't able to do this, and so we got someone to do this. And then it was a very gradual sort of process, and we were very aware of it the whole time. And now I think her mind is going a little bit as well. And it's very sad to see. And I don't want to make jokes about, you know, not caring for the elderly or
you're only joking.
Because I think I am very, very consciously aware of this, and it is a big problem in our society. But I think that I don't think we should just have these blanket assumptions where, we are... our society is mean to old people. Why can't people like Asia? I don't think Asia have the right model necessarily, but I like the Asian model, which is basically you're going to get your grandparents to move in with you again kind of thing. You know, that sort of happens. Then it's actually a very, very good thing to have these social things where lots of families live together under the same roof.
Until they accidentally see you naked, and then it's not such a good thing. Because I don't know, there's a line, isn't there?
Right.
You know, like you want to be free in your own house to do whatever you want. So like,
then again,
sometimes you don't want to get undressed in the bathroom to take a shower. Sometimes you want to get undressed outside of the bathroom and then walk your naked ass into the bathroom to take a shower. And
my nan has seen me naked.
Granddad's living with you
loads of times, though. You know, I mean, your parents have too, right? Up until the age of about sort of, you know. I don't know, maybe like 13. 18? I was just naked all the time.
What? No, I was going to say maybe the cutoff was like 5 or so, like 13. Like my grandma did not see me naked when I was 13, I can guarantee.
Well, okay, not
did
naked.
Did you still need help wiping your bum and stuff when you were 13? Is that
not fully nude? You know,
she saw my balls, but not my dick. they were hanging out of my shorts, but she didn't see my dick, so it's fine.
The thing is, culturally, in a lot of Asian countries, it's different about the sort of looking after the elderly. I'll give an example. Okay, when I went to Bali on my honeymoon, about 17 years ago now, I guess it would have been.
Oh,
and
shit.
Actually,
it was 16
years ago. Yeah, it is. But we were there.
People.
It is. We were there the year before.
All there for the hot weather. They don't have to wear the cardigans or anything.
There. It's just
free
warm.
Heating.
But you have to look after your parents if you're the youngest child, right? You're the youngest child. You got to look after the parents, and they name their kids like in order that they were born. So if you're the firstborn, your name will generally be
number one,
Putu.
Oh,
Putu or Gede or Wyan. Like these are the kind of names. And then the second born kid has a couple of names that they can choose from. So you know.
Number two.
Which order they're in.
Second.
Exactly. So our guide for the 2 weeks we were there, we had a guide who, when he'd meet us at the hotel and we'd get in his van and him and the driver would drive us around and he'd tell us all about the island. His name was Putu. And Putu is normally the firstborn son's name.
Okay,
but
yeah.
When they have too many kids, it just wraps around. So he's the younger Putu. So there's his older brother Putu, and he's Putu too, but he's the youngest Putu, okay? Right. So because he's the youngest, he has to look after the parents. Like, the youngest looks after the parents. All the older kids get to leave. He has to stay behind, look after the parents, and then they'll have to live with him, and that's the way it is. That's the way it's done. So we don't have any kind of system. Brothers and sisters just argue with each other about who's going to have to look after mum and dad now they're getting on. And I think it's kind of sad, but they've had to structure it into the fabric of their society.
It's because a social responsibility.
Given the choice, nobody wants their parents living with them. Once they're a grown up and you've got your own place, you don't want your mum and dad moving back in with you. It'd be awful.
No, it's like Everybody Loves Raymond all over again.
Yeah,
you're like,
exactly.
I know they don't quite live with them, but they're practically too close for comfort.
It certainly feels like you live here with me. I'm Raymond.
Everybody loves Raymond.
Raymond, you gotta respect your mom.
Yeah, Raymond, he's right. That's the whole show is about how miserable it would be to have your parents.
That's what your life is like in Bali, then, I guess, when your parents live with you.
I have
Everybody
heard
loves Putu. That's
these
what the.
It's really appropriate because I guess what happens is, as a civilization, when you have like 8 kids in each family, okay, at least then you've got like, if you're naming them, if Putu means first, and you know. Routine.
Well,
you
increase the odds of not having to look after your parents, I guess, when you have like a lot more kids than them.
Sure. But it's not going to increase your odds.
Are
is
you
it?
Shushing me?
You're not going to. What? Anyway, I'm just saying, in a class of kids, okay, if everyone is called, if you've got like, if the average family has got 6 to 8 kids, that's fine, okay? That, you know, that you've maybe you've got like 5 Putus or 6 Putus, but you've got a lot of other people, right?
Yeah.
Nowadays, people only have like 1.5 kids, okay, 1 to 2
kids.
Yeah,
nowadays they do.
So
I think it's because we're really precious nowadays, especially like people that are approaching their mid-20s or like their early 30s nowadays are used to having like lots of free time, you know, and then they have a kid and they think that it's going to be just like they saw in the movie, and they realize it's a lot of hard work, and then they're like, never again. I'm chopping off my dick. I'm not doing this again.
Exactly.
Just have one kid.
I can't imagine how the teachers would handle that class, though, if literally everyone in the class is called Putu.
Putu.
So how does that work, Pyrian?
I don't know, dude. I'm not Balinese. I mean, they make it work.
Well, why didn't you ask this question? This would be the first question I asked of the Putu.
They think they barcode them.
Can you ring them up?
Putu, it's Pyrian. Pyrian Flax. No, I know you don't remember me, but listen, I've got a question for you.
How would you know that you're talking to the right guy as
well
if you just rang him up and
that
said Putu? Because anyone in that family could answer. The dad's called Putu, the granddad's called Putu. One of his brothers is called the same.
I know.
It's not that far-fetched because in the West, everybody just like uses the same names as well. Every year, there's like 2 or 3 really popular names and guaranteed kid's going to be in a class with like 10 of them.
There's
literally 10 Khaleesis in my son's class. I'm not even kidding.
But let's say you knew 3 Teds. How would you differentiate them the same way you do everyone else? I'd be Bold Ted, and then there'd be Big Ted and Little Ted, or whatever.
You guys have an infestation of Toms in the office, and you guys cope.
Well,
there's like
barely.
10 Toms in the office.
But I think, do you know what I think what would happen, though? It's a little bit like if you say, Putu, do this. Someone will get up and do it. Okay,
the most Putu will do.
Putu will
get
up.
Like any Putu affixes, like they'll have like smelly Putu and tall Putu and dumb Putu and bucktooth Putu. Yeah, there'll be ways to differentiate them for sure. Because all of them,
they'd have nicknames. Like they'd probably call the youngest one would be like little brother or something like that. So they'd just say, little brother, you go do that. So you know, they'd have a way. I mean, it's not like they're just walking around confused all the time. You know, someone goes Putu, and everyone on the street turns around and goes, "Who could he mean? Is it me?
But
I don't know
like
you.
That.
Why are you calling me? I'm Putu."
Maybe it's like an ant colony, and just you know, anyone will be able to do it. Anyone will be able to answer your question. You know, you'll just stop a Putu on the street, and he'll talk to you as if he's the one you already know.
It sounds like it sounds like the name of a Pokemon. Is that is that where they got their inspiration?
I think so.
From?
Yeah.
Nice.
And the Putus evolve into Mega Putu.
I choose you, Putu.
Got to catch them all. One? But they've only got like seven
like
names.
Like 20 of them in a field. Huh? Me? You mean me?
A Putu ball. Catch him in the Putu ball.
Jesus Christ. So, yeah, oh, man, fuck. Tell me more about Bali. I want to know more about like
oh,
what you got
great.
To.
I went to a cockfight.
Oh, you didn't?
I did, yeah. It's a ceremonial thing that in the temples that they have in Bali, for the morning, sort of before the morning prayers and everything, they shed blood by sort of sacrifice, okay?
So the second son has to be sacrificed.
They sacrifice. They go through a lot of people. Like, it's a lot of
not
people.
My little Putu.
Yeah.
No.
Bloody Putu, they call him. He's always got cuts and things. So they'll kill a chicken or something. So to get around right. the fact that cockfighting is, you know, illegal in Bali, because, you know, you have to make that kind of stuff illegal. But everybody's like, ah, it doesn't matter. So they just kill a chicken by cockfight. Like, so they're still technically, it's a blood sacrifice. So they make out like it's a religious thing. So we're driving right. past this temple and there's all these guys shouting and waving and holding chickens. And I said to Putu, stop the van. I want to see a cockfight here before I go back. He's like, okay, but I'm really against it. And I was like, yeah, fair enough. But I, you know, I just want to see one. Just once, I want to see what's up. I've never been to one.
Oh, God.
And these guys look like they're having a great time. So I just love to see it. He was like, okay, I'll take you to the cockfight. So we go into the temple and there's all these guys. I'm like the only foreigner there. They all look at me for like 2 seconds and then they're back to looking at the cockfight. And they've got these two things. And I didn't realize that they put a razor on the sort of spur of the cockerel. Otherwise, the fight goes on too long. So you put this on there and then whichever one does it will just razor the other one. And that's it. Fight over. Blood sacrifice done. No suffering. They kill the chicken and on you go. Well, minor suffering anyway. So there's all these lads there and they're gambling like crazy. And Putu, who told me he wasn't into it, is front and center with a wad of money, like take a bet to make a bet. And he was really into it. And he says to me, which one's going to win? And they think because I'm like this foreign outsider, I'll pick the lucky chicken. So I was like, I think that one's going to win. And so like the betting was changing based on my prediction because they were all like, oh yeah, get in on the foreigner's bet. I want in on this. That's going to be lucky sort of thing. So they're all betting and the betting's exchanged. And then the guy's holding up the chickens and everyone's numbering like this. And then he holds up the other one. And then they poke them at each other. They're holding them tight and they're jabbing them at each other to get them all riled up. And then they throw them into the middle of this sort of little dusty ring and they just go at it. It's over in like 2 seconds. One of the cockerels raises the other one in the throat. Job done. They hold up the winning cockerel. He gets taken off to have sex with all the chickens he wants. And they wring the neck of the other one and job done. And on we went. And then money changes
hands.
Why
did they fight though? What did they do to them to make them so angry? Because they don't
naturally
fight. Cockerels
will fight. Like they're kind of, if you get a couple of angry cocks, sips,
right.
shit's going to kick right off, okay? Like just rutting cocks.
Yeah, but I guess if they're out in the
wild,
they can back off and go back to their herd and stuff.
But here,
and not claim the territory.
And because you've been poking them at each other, it's like starting a fight. It's like grabbing someone's hands and pushing another person, making them push each other, and then pushing them into a ring. And they're so stupid. They're like, "Hey, why were you pecking me?" You know, they don't say, "Wait a minute, why are we being forced into this futile struggle?" Just for another being's entertainment, let us be friends. And then the other cockerel sees an opening, slashes his throat, and lives. That's pretty much it. It was brutal.
Cockfighting is a little bit like what people did before Pokemon, right? You know, it's
man. I can't think of cockfighting and not think of that Seinfeld episode with the cockfighting and Lil Jerry.
Yeah,
remember that one?
That was a great
Fuck
episode.
Me. I've never been to like an animal. Fight like dog or cock. I know, like, I guess they're super illegal as well, but like, they're sort of well documented, right? Like, you always see them in movies and stuff. There's always a dog fight or a cock fight, and it's always something to do with, like, you know, it's like some shady underground, like, all right, we gotta go find Mr. Mistopheles. Where is he? He's underground. What's he doing? He's at a cockfight. Well, let's go find him. Like, it's always there, right? Because, like, all the gambling and stuff.
Yeah,
but, like,
yeah.
You're pretty fortunate in a weird sense that you've seen one, because, like, I don't think everybody will get to see one in their lifetime.
And, I mean, I just thought, I am never going to get another chance. It's like it's like a tradition here, so I kind of felt like I wasn't going to some seedy backroom thing.
No, like, if you were to do that in, like, England... You would feel horrible because, like...
And, like, all that stuff, like, badger baiting.
The caliber of people
and,
there as well would be, like, fuck, holy shit. Yeah. Stone cold killers.
I mean, they're gonna kill a chicken anyway. And this just adds perhaps a cruel moment in the front. The chicken's still going to die. It's still going to get its neck wrung, and they're still going to eat it. Like, you know, that's the way it goes. So I didn't feel terrible. It wasn't like a couple of dogs where you think, shit, this could have been somebody's pet. and now they're forcing it to fight. Like, that's brutal. This is it's a chicken, man. It's going to die anyway. Come on.
I think it's a big religious. There's a lot of religious attachment to it. It goes back a very, very long way. And I think that obviously one of the things that they're doing with those razors, I guess, is to shorten the suffering.
Oh, yeah. It goes
on
forever otherwise. Like, they're just raking at each other. You want it to be quick. You want it to be quick. Yeah.
Because back in the day, people had the stomachs for that. But nowadays, everybody's like too much of a pussy. They just want it to be over quick and they want to get their money.
It's just a chicken with his eye hanging out. What?
You watch a two-hour cockfight. You watch the whole thing. You're not a man.
These guys got to get to work, man. They got to do the temple stuff and go to work.
Oh, shit.
That's
course,
the bizarre thing that got me initially. I was like, the temple. They have to go into the temple to, I guess, religion, you know, it's very set in its ways. Maybe, you know, maybe the blood spilled on the blood sacrifice on the temple floor is like, harkens back to something. I don't know.
It was a big part of it. And the other thing is they have temples all over the island. Like, these are like, each family has a little temple, like going back for generations, that's been their little sort of shrine, if you like. So they're small. It looks like it's like maybe the size, you know a portable toilet, right?
Yeah.
Imagine a building with about three square of those, so about three cubed. So it's about three wide, three long, and about one high. It's like a shrine.
All right. Okay.
You don't really go in it. It's just, you know, it's got a little garden.
So
in
you could easily have one of those in your backyard, sort of thing.
Often they do. So you'll often
like a banana stand,
right? Size. Exactly. Yeah. And there's money in the banana stand, as we know. So you can go to.
There's cocks in that.
There's cocks in that banana stand.
Can you like upgrade each individual square? Like you could have like on one square, you could have like a little like basin for water, and then on another square, you could just have like one of those Japanese toilets that like sprays mist up your ass.
I'm sure you could, but I don't think they go to them often. They don't. It's not like a daily visit. Oh, I'm gonna go to the shrine again. Like it's just sort of something they tend.
Do you think it could be a daily thing though?
It could be. Yeah, if it was in your house. Yeah,
your pimpage. Yeah.
But it's like having an allotment. It was more like having an allotment. Yeah. You know, you tend to it occasionally, sort of thing. But they're literally everywhere, and legally they're not allowed to move them. Okay, so they're there, and that's that. So when you're going around, the road will sort of meander around this little shrine that's there in the middle of the road, sort of thing, and they're just sort of there everywhere. And the hotel we were staying at was a ridiculously nice hotel because my dad was like, "I'll send you guys somewhere nice for your honeymoon." I was like, "Thank you so much." That was like his present to us. So we're at this amazing, stunning 5-star hotel with this golf course. I don't play golf, but I thought I'd play it anyway. I'm sure I've told this story before, maybe even on the podcast.
So you just did everything while you were there.
Yeah, it was great. It was the best 2 weeks. But I'm playing golf on the golf course, and there's a shrine in the middle of the fairway on like the fourth hole. So there's this shrine, and my instructor, I'd had like a week of lessons. Every time I had a lesson, he'd just sort of shake his head. we'll try again tomorrow. Like that. Like I just couldn't get the hang of it. I was terrible. I was really stiff, and I didn't get the hang of the swing. And I was just like hacking at this ball.
It's all in the hips. You got to like
exactly.
Move your hips.
It's kind of loose, you know. And I didn't get that. And his English was very halting, so he couldn't really tell me what was going wrong. But he knew to say very bad, very very bad, like that. But it's pretty much
Putu disappointed with you.
Putu
swing hips.
Putu hates you. Putu hate your swing. I was like, okay, I get it. So we're
go
out there
inside
on the
and
fairway.
Putu will give you massage. This is different Putu, not me.
This is Lady Putu. God. Don't be afraid. So I'm on the fairway and I'm ready to drive. And he says to me, "Don't hit the shrine." It's like, okay. He says, "Do not hit the shrine. We'll get in big trouble." I was like, okay, okay, okay. So
oh my God, it's like putting a ball through your neighbor's window.
Exactly.
That's what
So what do you think I did? I sliced this thing.
And hit the shrine.
Pings off the shrine. This chunk of masonry falls off the wall.
A mini nuclear detonation.
It was terrifying.
Small mushroom cloud on the fairway.
I just sort of when you hunch your shoulders, like you're sort of like that. And I look at presumably Putu, and I can't remember his name. And he sort of looks at me and he's making the same expression. And the girl on the golf cart is making the same expression. So hop in the golf cart and zoom to the next hole. He's just like, just play on.
The door to the shrine opens up and like two chickens and like two men come running out.
Oh man, it was rough. Like it was just unbelievable. It was absolutely unbelievable. But we just went to the next hole. Man. But the girl that drove the golf cart was also responsible for going and fetching the golf balls that I would slice into the undergrowth. And she did it like she was unbelievable. Like I would slice this thing into what looked like a jungle, and she'd just leap off the golf cart and sprint in there full pace, and she'd have the ball in like 2 seconds. And at the end, the guy said to me, because you tip everybody in Bali if you're a foreigner, because they all earn so little, right? And I said to him, how much should I tip her? Because she worked really hard. He said, oh, don't give her much. She's just the golf cart girl. And I was like, and so I gave him a good tip and I gave her the same amount. And this caused some kind of friction. But the amount that I'd given her.
You have to be careful.
Yeah, you do. But the amount that I'd given her was so much that she was like stunned. But it was like £5. But to them, that was like most of the people that worked at the hotel didn't earn a salary. They earned like a meal. That was what they got paid in. So they'd come into work.
Fuck.
They'd eat breakfast at home. They'd come into work. They'd get a lunch at the restaurant. It would be nice food because it's like the hotel food. But that was it. And then they were, and then in the evening they were off. But they worked like 18-hour days for no actual money, just food. So that's saving the family some money. And she's out of the house, I guess, and tips is what they live on. So they're at the hotel. They don't get paid by the hotel because the hotel's like, what? We're feeding you and you get tips from all these rich foreigners. What more do you want? It's shocking. So when I gave her the tip, that was like a big chunk of change for a Balinese lady. But yeah, it was scary. I mean, that was the problem is it was this beautiful island, but I felt super depressed because anytime you went anywhere, there were just all these incredibly poor people who were so grateful. They were trying to sell shit all the time. If we're taking a coach trip somewhere, they're running alongside the van that we were in, like banging on the windows and holding up shit they're selling. And this guy's got like this beautifully carved mahogany sort of little sort of snake thing he's trying to sell. This other guy's trying to sell some sort of wooden kitchen implements. And this other guy, swear to God, he's carrying this full-size grandfather clock that he's carved out of a tree. He's just running alongside with his thing.
Just bonging away.
Just bong, carrying this bong, thing. And bong. I was like, how much is that going to be? Because, you know, he said, $10, $10. I was like, and they love the haggle. Fuck. So if I'd said, I'll give you $5 for the grandfather clock, he would have been like, yeah, no problem. So I just thought, you could come here with £100 and leave with like a van load of stuff just by exploiting how desperate they are. It was crazy.
Haggling is hard, isn't it? Because like, I think haggling works if you're from that country and you sort of know your way around haggling. But when you're from a foreign country that's perceived as like very wealthy and that you're just like a walking ATM to them sort of thing, it's impossible to haggle. They're just like, nah, fuck you. No, I'm not haggling with you.
It's kind
like,
of,
you're
going to
pay me a full premium price. I don't even want to haggle.
Yeah, like, I'm sure they stick the price high, but they still haggle. Like if you go they'll say 100 whatevers and you'll say, I'm not paying 100. And they'll say 80 whatevers. And you'll say, geez, 80. Come on, I'll give you 60. And I realize I'm haggling over 5p. Like that's how much it is to me. But they're doing it and I'm doing it. And you realize you're haggling over literally pocket change. Like,
I tried to haggle with an Egyptian taxi driver one time and he was just not having it. I was like, I was ready for it too. I was like, oh fuck, okay, here we go. Now we're gonna haggle. And he's like, 20 pounds. It was like Egyptian pounds.
Right.
20 pounds. I was like, no, come on, 19. He's like, 20. Like, well, how about 18? 20 pounds. He was just not fucking having it. He was so mad.
Shit.
He was so fucking grouchy as well. And I was like, all right, fine. Let's get out of here. 20 pounds. Just like ran out. I don't even know where we just got out in the middle of nowhere as well. Fucking place. Like Egypt was like, I went on a similar trip to Egypt. It was like, it wasn't like a honeymoon or anything like that, though. It was just a trip for the sake of a trip sort of thing. And like, I don't know if Bali's like this, but you know, we got a 5-star hotel and we thought, fuck, it's going to be amazing. It wasn't like that amazing. Like a 5-star hotel in Egypt is just like not great. Like they need like
it's
a higher
like a
star rating or something for the better hotels. Cause like 5 stars just wasn't enough. Everything just sounded like it was going to be so much better than it was. Mm. And like, we were just like it was just like disappointment after disappointment. And then when we left, we were like, oh fuck.
That's a shame.
I didn't like Egypt and I never want to come back. It was, oh God, it was.
The art of haggling, though, is it's much easier to haggle when you don't want something, right? It's like, you know, someone comes up to you, you know, you're at a place like browse around, they say, you know, carpet, £100. And you say, well, like,
fuck you.
I don't want a carpet. And then they go, £80. No, I don't want it. 60. No, I don't want any carpet. 50. It's like, okay, fine. Do you know what? I'll have a carpet. That's the best way to negotiate, right? But if you went in there and said, hey, I'm looking to buy a carpet, what have you got? And he's like, I got this, £200. And you're like, well, if you say, oh, sure, I want a carpet, £200. But that's a bit expensive. Maybe I'll pay 180. You know, do you know what I mean? If you don't want something in the first place, or at least if you have the attitude of not wanting it, that's the best way to move forward. If you go out with the intention, they see you, they clock you. It's all about body language. It's about doing it. This is their thing that they've done day in, day out for like 50 years. you know, they can read you.
They try to sell so much crap, though. Like, I remember when we went around Europe, we took trains around Europe and just, like, for 2 weeks, just took trains and tried to, like, visit all, like, the major cities.
Did you give them back?
Hey!
No.
That
anyway, so we went around, and every train station is littered with people who are clearly on massive amounts of drugs all the time, like, real down and outs and stuff, and people trying to sell stuff, like... But not you know, not a guy with a hand-carved grandfather clock. Like, they buy really cheap shit, like, you know, dancing Mickey Mouses. You know, those, like, wiry things that dance when music plays somehow. But they're cheap as anything. And you just saw them everywhere. Like, there's always, like, a guy standing outside the train station with, like, a bed sheet on the ground. And it was just covered in these dancing fucking Mickey Mouses and stuff. Yeah. And then occasionally you'd have, like... You know, like in Paris, they'd have people selling like all these, like, they looked like they were made of pewter, but they weren't. They were just plastic with like gold paint on them, Eiffel Towers and shit like that. But when we were in, I think it was Rome or it might have been Venice, there's this one street we went down and it was just full of these people selling these, and like the Mickey Mouses were there, of course, but like, you know, all these like souvenirs and stuff. So this is all like laid out on the ground, like on a bed sheet or like on a pillowcase or something. And these guys just standing around listening to music, trying to sell this stuff. And so we're going through and then we come across this guy and he's got this sheet down and he's like, the stuff he was selling was just... somebody's purse and the contents of that purse that he stole, clearly. It was like one purse and then there was like a lipstick and like a little mirror. And it was like, it was just like, it wasn't even like duplicates of anything. It was all just, you can just tell he just snatched this purse and he was just trying to sell everything inside it. Fuck, it was so weird. That's, it was amazing. Pretty funny, yeah.
I got a complete change of subject here. This was something that really, really made me laugh this morning, okay? I'm on the way back from dropping the kids at school, and it's recycling day around here on a Thursday, and so everybody's put out their recycling. Something has fallen out of one of the recycling bins, and it's a piece of junk mail. I can tell straight away because I got the same piece of junk mail. It's like something from Barclaycard. It was for Mrs. F. It was just like their usual mass billing thing that they do. Mail ad that just says, hey, you can get a credit card now with an incredible rate of 1,000 APR. Sign up here. Like, you can see the branding was the same logo on the front, same little word, and I could see it and everything. But written on the front of the envelope was, stop moving my letters. Right, was written there, like scrawled there in biro. And I realized, like, this had been written because someone in this person's house was moving their letters around. And they'd seen this letter wherever they leave their post. Like, most people, when the post comes in, they've got like a little table or they tuck it in. Like, there's a place where you put the post so it's not just on the mat next to the front door.
Right.
And they'd obviously been, someone in their house that they were living with was moving their letters.
Now, or maybe it was like a house like that converted into flats or something.
Well, no, you know, but sometimes... these are all flats. So this bit along here is all flat. They're not me, but like our house is all our road is all terraced houses. But the other part, sort of next to our road that I walk past, it's ex-council flats that are now just flats, right? So this is someone living in the house, and whoever they're living with, their family or their housemate or whatever, has been moving their letters. Their nan.
It's actually your nan, isn't it? It's your house.
It's my nan, obviously. This was your house. It is not. I want to stop that right there. This is not me, okay? I do not care about who moves my, quote, letters.
I do not move anyone's letters.
I do not. It was not me.
You have, like, there's... Where the letters go, you've, like, drawn a square and they have to fit in there perfectly.
A dotted line and the letters go in there, exactly. But what I liked about it was...
Was this very angrily written?
Very. Like, scratched. Really scratched. So... First of all, whoever's writing it, I like the idea that their letters have to be in this place, not in the other place. Okay. And then they've obviously re-put the letters where they were, and they've written on the top one, stop moving my letters.
Good enough.
For the next person, like whoever it is that's moving them is going to come to move them, are going to be like, whoa, and see that note, which I thought was really funny that they didn't just say to them, can you stop moving my letters? They've had to really angrily write, stop moving my letters.
That's a very British thing as well, isn't it?
But second of all, nobody gets letters anymore. It's all junk mail or a bill. That's it. So I also like the idea that this person
exactly,
sits
yeah.
there with their letters. Oh, my correspondence has arrived. And they sit
from
in their armchair.
In Peru.
And they open it up. Ah, oh, Barclaycard. Yes, I'm on very good terms with Barclaycard. They write to me often. Thank goodness this letter wasn't moved, or I would have moved this, missed this important missive from Barclaycard.
I don't know what I would do if somebody had moved my letters.
I would never have known about this fabulous offer, or with a short time of availability.
How would I know that you can get 10% off a greasy pizza from the local established pizzamant?
Pizzamant.
For only the next 14 days.
Pizzeria.
This cab firm has been in contact with me before. I believe I shall do business with this local cab firm. They also run a car to Heathrow, did you know? I would not have known that had someone moved my letters.
I don't know. But maybe, listen, some people just have very spidery, angry-looking handwriting. Because
no,
people
dude.
Don't write very often these
no,
days.
It was
so maybe
written
it was just
you could tell a lot by handwriting.
Blood.
Like, you know...
Yeah, they've written in blood.
You know, remember when you used to exchange notes with girls in school, and girls always had really upbeat, bubbly writing.
Like, yes,
you know, like with big circles on the eyes and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and like, and it would always be like, oh man, I can't believe, like, I can't even remember what she looks like, but I bet she's pretty hot based on this handwriting.
Yeah, it's all boobs and butts, all of their lettering.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's like really curvy lettering and stuff.
Yeah.
And then me is like all. Just it looked like a 3-year-old
with a crayon,
crayoning.
Well,
yeah. My handwriting doesn't reveal much about me except that I'm a dumbass.
Like, yeah, that's same. It. People look at my handwriting like I have to write in the reading record. So when my kids come home from school with reading books, we read them and then I write in the little record book what books they read and how they did, so the teacher can keep tabs on how their reading's going and whether they should move them up a group or down a group or whatever. And I've realized now that the teacher must look at my handwriting and think, such a shame that their father is mentally backwards because...
Oh, man. So my wife does all that. Her handwriting, I'm not even joking, is like fucking amazing. It's like reading a printout like from a computer.
Mine
it's
is
like
terrible.
So clear and perfect. And then mine just looks fucking awful. Like
well,
it's offensive. It's so bad.
For me, like, I guess... Because I grew up having access to a word processor and a computer and typing stuff.
Fancy.
Look at Mr. Fancy.
I grew
pants
up
here.
In a word processor household, so I am
no,
a
but
privileged
the thing is, it was at the time that was pretty unusual, right?
Mm.
I only had that. It was like a BBC computer, and the only reason we had that was because my dad did accounting on it. It was expensive to buy that
did,
kind of stuff.
Did they have QuickBooks back then? Was it like a big deal? Like. I have to take a week off work to do my accounts.
These computers he only had, he didn't actually do accounting on them. He just used it to send out posh-looking letters. And it was like almost like an expensive typewriter kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I sort of only half-learned joined-up writing, okay? So my writing's not very good either, but I kind of obviously got about halfway through learning joined-up writing when someone said, don't bother, no one's going to need to write anymore. And so... My writing is sort of, so some letters I do joined up and others I don't. I guess everyone's at a different stage. But the same thing, though, happened with like touch typing and learning to type fast. So I see some people around the office and it's people that you wouldn't think, okay? They are right down, looking at the keyboard, pecking away with like two fingers.
Ugh.
And it's very surprising who those people are. And I can't touch type perfectly. When you see someone who can, you're amazed. But my sort of, I was very self-taught, and I guess a lot of people must be, but back then you could learn. You could go through programs and teach you how to
Mavis
type
Beacon
optimally.
Teaches typing.
And it's a good investment to have, by the way, to properly learn. And there's probably like websites you can go to
you
now.
You
had
to do the thing, the quick brown fox jumps over the brown log thing. Did you guys do those?
Lazy dog.
Lazy
dog, yeah.
That's the thing they used to show all of the letters on the...
The quick brown fox jumped over the brown fox. I'm pretty sure...
The two cockerels enter the shrine Poo-Too. And the man hits the golf ball and Poo-Too gives him a rub down. I don't know. What's going on?
So no, I'm exactly the same as you. I half learned to write and I half learned to type.
I don't think he said that was the case with him, though. He just said his handwriting is fucking bad.
I mean, it's bad because when I'm writing...
Like me.
And I'm sure this... Like, my handwriting wasn't always terrible. I mean, recently I have uncovered all my old D&D books and I put them up because I've got these new shelves. Anyone that's watched my stream will have seen. I've got new shelves and I've liberated all my nerd
stuff. Saw.
Right. It's all up.
I noticed that the weird clinical bed is still in there, though.
It's,
I guess
it's
you can't
just
really...
the bed, but there's nowhere else to put it. Like, Mrs. F
you
was
know
like,
what it
get
is,
rid of the
though?
Bed,
it's,
but we need it.
It's just
his
it's
gran
the frame.
Has to sleep somewhere.
No, she's put in this. She's
just
in the spare
room. Just put the mattress
room.
On the floor. And get rid of the frame.
That looks terrible. The frame is a nice frame. I don't know why everybody hates it. It is a nice frame. It's just because it's white.
It looks like an asylum frame.
Honestly, you're seeing the other end of it. If you see the nice end of the frame, it's nice. It's like...
Well, turn the fucking bed around
no,
then.
No, I don't want to have to turn it around. Because then I'd have to take it apart. The room is small enough that I can't actually turn it around. Like,
sucks,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? So it's like, this is the way it is. I built it this way. It's going this way. It's fine. It's fine. So anyway.
Is the room too small or is
the room
bed
what?
Too big?
Both. That's a good question. Oh.
What size bed is it? Just to give us a
it's
little
just a single bed.
Idea of.
It's just a single bed.
All right.
But I've realized that the width of the room is a single bed plus maybe 2 feet. So when I'm trying to turn this thing with all the other furniture in here, it's not going to happen.
Is that room like the box room?
This is the box room.
Like,
this is the box room.
It's so small that it's not even really a room.
Exactly. I made it into an office and now it's got all
my
shit.
That's a good idea.
It is. Yeah. So, I'm now looking through all my old D&D books and role-playing books and my handwriting used to be pretty good because I had to write all these adventures and shit. So I'm looking at it, I'm like, wow, my handwriting used to be pretty good. But I didn't have a computer back then. And I've realized that now I've got a computer. When I'm writing, what I'm thinking is, why isn't this quicker? Like, I could type this quicker. So I'm writing
at
the speed
but
I
not just that.
Type.
Your wrist hurts, like, after
really,
2 seconds
quickly.
Of writing.
Yeah. But yeah. It's just the fact that I'm trying to write at the same speed I type at, and it's just so slow and laborious, I just get bored of making the letters look like letters, and they just turn into squiggles.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
I see.
It's
That's where shorthand and stuff like that comes in, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen, just to change the subject again, I know that we don't talk about video games on this podcast much because it leads to depressing chats, but I don't normally play horror games because I don't like them, but I played Resident Evil 7 and
I saw
it is fucked up, like really fucked up. No, it's good though. It's well done. Like,
okay.
I, if you like that sort of thing, I would play it. Like,
okay.
I think it's like 10 hours, apparently, and it's like, the story seems cool. I had to read about the story because there's no hope of me ever finishing the game, but like...
Really?
It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's like...
Are you just not
everybody's,
good with scary
everybody's
stuff?
Saying that this game is like saved, like the Resident Evil
yeah, that's what I
franchise
heard, yeah.
because the last game was like not very good and
oh,
whatnot.
Fuck
but,
off.
So they stripped
fuck
it.
Right off. Saved the fucking franchise. Like, it's had like four bad games in a row. They put this one would have been shit. They would have made another one. It would have sold enough copies to make another one, and that one would have been shit. I don't think just because a good one
faith.
Comes along, they
people
can say, oh, it
faith.
Suddenly saved the whole thing.
It would
thing.
Have gone down the can for sure. Like,
no,
you can't,
no, it hasn't
you can't
gone
just
down the can after 20
shit.
Bad games. It's never going to. It's a little bit like
I don't
XCOM.
Think that's how it works.
You know, with XCOM, we were talking about this last night. They made XCOM and they were good games. Then they made like 17 bad ones. And
yeah,
then they
and
rebooted
then, and
it,
the franchise
and it
was dead.
They stopped,
you know,
making
they
them.
Stopped making them. It died. It was only, it took them 20 years for somebody, an old fan of the genre and the original games to revive it and
well,
make it good again.
Well, maybe it was better off dead.
No, it's great. Well,
the studio oh, and shit. The publisher that made the original games are both long gone now because
yeah,
they
yeah.
were so terrible. Like they had to sell the IP like 3-4 times to different companies who picked it up and did worse with it, sort of thing. It's only now that XCOM is back. So
it's back,
I think
baby.
That they could easily ditch Resident Evil, or it was heading for the ditch by the sounds of it.
Isn't it?
And,
oh, yeah.
And they decided with this game that they were going to strip it back down, make it like just a horror game, a really simple horror game. And I mean, don't take it from me because I don't play horror games. I don't know which ones are good and which ones aren't. But this game really scared the bejesus out of me.
So was it jump scares?
There was a couple of jump scares in the hour and a half that I played it. But the lead up to them was super well done. Like, there was a lot of like tropes and a lot of like sort of things like that I could
creepy
guess
children.
Were going to happen. There's a creepy child in it somewhere.
Okay.
At least there's some imagery
is
alluding
there a clown
to that.
Mask?
No clown mask, which I was surprised about. So I was streaming this yesterday, and I was pulling out all the stops in terms of trying to not be scared of this game, okay?
Okay, like, you so know, you were, like all you the, were all, playing all in the broad shit. Daylight with, like, yeah. you know, midday.
The sun was shining in.
Okay.
I was like, and I was literally resorting to shit that you resort to when you're like 6 years old and you're scared of something.
So were you
like,
playing it in a window with Twitch chat on the other fingers, monitor?
Yeah, fingers okay. in front of my eyes, like oh. just like looking through the crack of my fingers because I was so scared. Oh. I had to put music on to like lighten the mood a bit. I had to pause it like constantly and like sort
oh, God,
of like,
that's the one which I do when I'm watching a horror film, just pausing it. Yeah, pausing it and like stopping.
And you pause yeah. it and you just have to like you just have to calmly collect yourself again, and then you know sort of like beef yourself up a bit
sometimes,
for like the next
though, sometimes
five
all these
minutes.
Things make it worse though. Sometimes you think these things are going to help, but they actually just
it builds
make
anticipation.
It worse.
Yeah, in my mind it was much worse than the reality, because like when stuff finally did happen, it was like, oh, it was like kind of scary, but it was like, oh, you know, it wasn't that bad. I'd really built it up to be this huge thing that it wasn't.
Do you know what the key is? The key is to playing horror games and not getting scared. And I've started doing this if I ever play one.
Right, okay. This is some good advice.
This is
not being a PU55Y. Yeah,
this is good advice.
BITCH.
This is how you get past it, all right? For anyone out there watching and thinking, oh, I always try to play horror games but I get too scared. Fail a lot early on. Just get killed by everything. Find out all the scary stuff. If you're scared, run through it as an experiment and say, all right, this is creepy, but let's find out. Let's just run through. Treat it like a game. So don't get so invested in it. This is it. If you want to somehow play and not really enjoy
I still think for it, I think my experience was better because I was so scared. And I think it's designed to be like
exactly.
that. And
if you
play it that way and you are fucking scared and you're just so fucking reluctant to do anything, like I just noped out like 20 times.
I literally
pressed Alt F4 and I was like, fuck, I can't play this. Like I'm about to have a heart attack.
But
then I came back because I was like, oh, fuck, I want to see, like, because it's this really creepy fucking story. Like, it's like, it borrows heavily from the first season of True Detective, I found. You remember that?
I
don't know if you guys watched
show.
It, but it takes place, like, in the fucking,
the
deep south. Yeah. And it's all these, like, old-ass fucking shitty houses, and they're, like, you know, you go in them and there's just like fucking plates of maggots and stuff like
that. Yeah, it's like Florida noir horror stuff.
Yeah. So the first part of the game, and maybe even the rest of the game, I'm not sure, but I'll never know now. But the first like hour and a half of the game, you're in one of those houses and it's dark and there's nobody there, but there's people there. And like, cause you can hear them every once in a while and shit, but you're sort of like thumbing around with a flashlight trying to find out what's going on and shit. And it's like, the lead up to shit happening is like so fucking creepy and stuff. And like eventually you go down into the cellar and it's like a fucking torture dungeon and there's all this shit. And it's like, play it, man. I think you'd like it, Lewis. Like for a single player experience.
I'll pick it up. Yeah, this weekend.
Blast through it in like 10 hours and see what you think. But it's fucking good, man. It's like really like somehow, even though I was super scared, I was like, I wanted to play it more, but I can't. I'm too much of a pussy. Like,
I
want to
play that game, My Neighbor, I think it's called.
Okay.
Or Hello Neighbor, I think it's called. And it's basically you have to break into your neighbor's house. And it's very cartoony. Like, he's this big, burly guy that looks like a fairly wealthy, middle-aged guy who's maybe, he used to be kind of athletic in his youth, and now maybe he still goes shooting occasionally. You know, he's got that look about him. He chases you around. You've got to try and hide from him. So it's like a stealth game, but you have to run from him. You can barricade stuff, and sometimes he will do stuff to try and trap you. So he will barricade doors, and you can take out light bulbs to sort of hide in the dark and stuff. If you watch some videos, right, it looks absolutely petrifying.
So it's coming out in summer. It says, Hello Neighbor is a stealth horror game about sneaking into your neighbor's house and figuring out what he's hiding in the basement.
Right.
However, he is an advanced AI who learns from your actions. So you have to try and outsmart
him. So another thing that apparently is like a big thing that you can do with Resident Evil 7 is you can play it in VR.
Oh, fuck that.
Fuck that. Like, there's no fucking way.
I made it 1 minute into the VR horror demo where you're just walking around a creepy house and then something jumps out at you. 1 minute, all right? I'm walking down the hallway, a picture falls off the wall, I took off the headset. I was like, I'm done. That's it. And they were like, this was the demo.
I startle really fucking easily too. Yeah. Like if I'm outside walking and a horn honks, that'll startle me.
Same.
I'll be like, whoo! You like, yeah. So like fucking jump scares, I'm hopeless.
Yeah, it's
like
awful.
I can't do
honestly,
it.
Honestly, like, the people have got so good at making these games and making these films where they really just hone in on what makes you scared, what makes a human like terrified, that when it comes to doing it for VR, I feel like it's like easy mode all again. You know, it's like if we apply these things that we know work well on just a 2D thing, now put it into like a much more immersive environment. And oh my God, some people absolutely worship these horror things though. Like Hannah loves the adrenaline stuff that comes from getting a bit scared, you know? And so she's like a big aficionado, plays all the horror games, watches all the horror films, just can't get enough of it.
I hate it. I honestly hate it.
It's really,
I think it's like
me.
An adrenaline junkie thing. Maybe it's like a little bit like doing skydiving or something.
I mean, if that's the case, just go fucking skydiving.
Yeah.
Like, don't watch scary, like some weird fucking debasing horror movie. Like, it, you know, it's awful. Like, even in the game, like the shit that, like, you fight this. Well, I don't want to spoil it in case you guys play it, but like, it's fucking gruesome, man. Like, some really gory shit happens, and it's like, Jesus Christ! Like,
well,
there's
different levels of hit horror. Like, obviously you can sometimes have a film that's all psychological horror, and you never even see the kind of the creepy. There's never any gore.
Like
and
when
other
a stranger
ones
calls
gore
back, like a suspense one. Remember? Do you remember that movie When a Stranger Calls Back? Do you remember watching that when you were like smaller?
Or, I don't remember.
Like in your teens or whatever. I went to a sleepover party, okay, like when I was like 10, okay, like it was a birthday thing. And the big thing was you always had to rent a horror movie.
Right. But when a stranger calls back.
You couldn't rent something too gory.
So
your
I've never heard of
never
this movie, right? But this is obviously something from your childhood. It's an hour and a half long, 1993, made for TV, psychological horror film.
Yeah.
Okay. A sequel to the 1979 When a Stranger Calls. So When a Stranger Calls Back was the follow-up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the whole movie is a woman alone in a house, okay? And it's like, there's like a fucking thunderstorm outside, of course, like this spooky night. This person keeps phoning. And at first, it's like, he phones up and he's like, oh, hey, you know, I live a couple doors down and I'm on my own or whatever. Is Jenny around or something? Like, no, Jenny's not here. I'm babysitting. And blah, 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 blah. And it starts off all nice and stuff.
Yeah,
it just progressively gets creepier and creepier. And he's like, I'm in your house now. And she's like, stop following you. What the fuck? And everything. And, you know, it's this huge suspense trip. And it is like this psychological thing. And
slasher.
The whole time,
is it a slasher?
Yeah. And it's one of these ones where you're just like, the whole time, you're just like, I can't look. I don't want to pause it. I need to go to the bathroom. And you're just trying to like not wimp out. And like, you're in a room with like all these other guys that you're having a sleepover with. And some of them are just like, no, the fuck, this fucking movie sucks. Let's go smoke or something. You're like, ah, geez. Oh, God. What am I going to do? It's like, oh, fuck me. Yeah. Like suspense and horror and stuff is just like not for me at all. I can't do it.
Oh, it's too much. Oh, it's really interesting. This is so, flipping heck. There's like, a lot of these things come from something before, okay? Everything's built on each other. So when I just looked this up on Wikipedia and it took me on this little journey backwards. So it said, you know, When a Stranger Calls Back is obviously a sequel to the classic When a Stranger Calls, which is from 1979. I don't know which one you saw, but I assume 1993.
I think it might have been When a Stranger Calls, but it could have been When a Stranger Calls Back. I don't know.
It feels like that's the kind of thing you might watch, like when you were.
It was the one like, where she's trying to find him, and she knows he's in the house, and she can't find him, and then it turns out in the end. He was wearing like, it might have been When a Stranger Calls Back because it sounds so fucking dumb. Like maybe it is When a Stranger Calls Back. He's wearing like a fucking bodysuit with like bricks painted onto it so that he can blend in with the brick wall.
Okay.
So stupid.
And that's the thing at the end. And it's like, oh fuck, the whole time he was in the house.
He was
phoning.
The phone
he was
call
phoning
was
from within the house
from the
and
brick
he was
wall.
Camouflaging with the brick wall.
That sounds ridiculous.
Yeah. But you know, it's like, whatever.
I love that. So that was inspired by the classic folk legend of the babysitter and the man
the
upstairs.
The phone calls coming from inside the house. That's what the operator says. The first time I heard that story, it scared the shit out of me. I would have been about 11 or 12 years old. And my friend and I were reading, he had this book of scary stories, and we were reading it together, and we were sort of reading it, and we just sat there next to each other, like in his room, we're just reading the book next, like to it together. And you could tell we were reading at the same speed, because we both got to the final, like the reveal, and we both went white as a sheet. Like, we were both petrified by this story. Yeah. And it was like, we both sort of looked at each other with this look of utter terror. And I mean, it's not scary now. Like, it's a trope, you know, it's like so cliche. But the thing is, the first time you hear all this stuff, it's not cliche for you. It's genuinely terrifying. So we were like, oh my God, that was so scary. Like, we couldn't believe it. And we went downstairs and told his dad. And his dad was like, geez, that's like the oldest story around. Come on, how does that scare you? And we're like, well, we only just heard it for the first time. It's still scary. So, yeah.
Man, similarly, I remember being in my friend's basement, okay? I was sleeping at his house, and we were watching Jerry Springer at like 2 a.m, okay? And we're just sitting there watching it, and you know, it was like talking about like this, you know, this lover's tiff or whatever, and this girl Cindy comes on.
Woo, Cindy!
And she's all like, oh, you know, like, we dated a couple of times and he said this and that, and they're like trying to work it out or whatever. And like Cindy came out, and we're like, holy shit, Cindy's pretty good looking. And so we're watching this, and then Springer comes out and he's like, all right, everybody, but there's a twist to this. And you're like, all right, Jerry, what's the twist? And you're like, well, what Gary doesn't know is that Cindy is actually a man.
Ooh,
and it was that moment. It was the same moment you just described. Me and my friend both like turned our heads, looked at each other, both white as a sheet. We're like, what? This is possible? Like, bearing in mind, this is like 1990.
Yeah, it was like, new then. What? Like the what? First what time the they did fuck? The Cindy's actually a dude, it blew everybody's
Cindy
mind.
Cindy is a man? How the fuck? She looks so much like a woman. Like, is this what we have to look forward to in our adulthoods? Like, we're not going to know and stuff? Like, we were so fucking scared. It was, like, unbelievable. About the dumbest fucking thing. Like, when we were kids, right?
Yeah,
But it was just, like, I'll never forget that moment. Like, we've just...
You were there.
It was just, like...
With Poo-Too.
It was just this...
Poo-Too. Poo-Too couldn't believe it.
Man, we were just...
You mean
Poo-Too
is Poo-Tee? What is going on?
What?
Poo-Tina.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Oh, all right.
Me.
We got a bodega. Anyway.
We do. It's an interesting one this week. It's very very bodega. Different to the other ones. But are you ready?
Is it?
Yeah. I don't know quite how to pronounce this. It's Spanish for 12. So is it doce or doce? I can't remember. Anyway, part 12. Let's say it that way. Bodega. Part 12. 0101001101. Droned Kretos Nebish, one of the most surveilled men in the galaxy. He was arguably the best and most prolific computer hacker in the galaxy, and for 3 years he'd been under house arrest in his apartment on Snide 4, and for that entire period, even in his sleep, he'd been emitting a string of binary digits. Investigator Patar knew this, because for those 3 years she'd been watching Nebish on a small monitor in a tiny, cramped, hateful surveillance truck jammed up against her large, sweaty, hateful tech assistants. Anything today, she asked, wheezing on a vape and sipping a scoffy. Nah, said the tech guy. Even in those 3 years, she hadn't spoken with the tech guys other than in a professional capacity. She'd just sat there fiddling with her phone, waiting for Nebish to do something, to give himself away somehow, to slip up. He hadn't. The binary was, presumably, Nebish's way of flarving with the feds. As soon as his trial at the Supreme Court of Snide had ended the way it had, in a legal deadlock, he was doomed. Any trial on Snide was essentially a life sentence, thanks to the insanity of their judiciary. 90% of the beings on Snide were lawyers, or worked for lawyers. The other 10% were cops or judges. Every other need and function was handled by robot. Everything was automated. Except, by law, the law. As a result, the planet's entire economy was structured around lawsuits. And naturally, Patar was being sued by both of her tech assistants, and she in turn was countersuing them. The cases would never see a courtroom, thanks to the decades-long backlog. However, since the economy of Patar depended on people's possible lawsuit settlements, this was fine. She could get a mortgage using her lawsuit as collateral. Her bank would naturally sue her in return, but this was all part of the arrangement. 0-1-1-1-0-0-1-1-0-0-1-1-0. For the first few weeks, the surveillance team had worked around the clock to figure out what the binary code meant. Sometimes it turned out to be a recipe for soup. Other times it was just a string of prime numbers. Once it was the transcript for the entire 12-season run of How I Sued Your Mother, a popular sitcom starring, of course, robots. After they realized he was messing with them, they stopped trying to work out what the code was and just recorded it. Years worth of ones and zeros, and none of it meant a thing. Nebish knew that there were hundreds of people watching and listening to his every move. Not just the feds, but every law firm in town was also watching him. He had chosen to defend himself in court, and under Snydian law, this meant he was open to being sued by every law firm that he hadn't hired. Each was entitled to surveil him themselves, and each did. And since his apartment, by nature of his crimes, was a Faraday cage, it was impossible to listen in from a distance. No communication could be made into or out of Nebish's lair except by Hardline. Hence why the outside of his apartment was a mass of cables and wires, each leading to a van parked in the melee of vehicles that encircled his dwelling. His apartment itself was isolated, raised up on stilts so that it could be observed from every angle. The interior was a mass of tiny cameras and bugging devices. If Nebish moved, the cameras knew. When he was eating, watching TV, sleeping, taking a crap, it was all being recorded by hundreds of people. Worse still, Nebish was locked in and they were locked out. He'd placed an impenetrable Shrovian force field around the apartment to protect himself from assassins, and the code lock was on the outside, so he could never be coerced into opening it. He was unassailable and uncorruptible. No legal compunction or physical threat could force him to open the force field because it was impossible for him to do so. Similarly, nobody could ever crack the code, so it was impossible to break in. He couldn't signal outside anyway, thanks to the Faraday cage. It was a remarkable stalemate. Nothing got in, nothing got out, except for the surveillance footage, and the feds and the lawyers had control of that. As a result of this mess, the Nebish case was the number one employer on Snide 4. If the case ever ended, it would disrupt the economy so much that it would lead to a runaway recession. Investigator Pitar shuddered. Her entire existence and the livelihoods of billions of people involved surveilling a man whose case was so important it couldn't be allowed to end. She picked up her phone and checked the news feed. Nothing of interest. Pork belly futures were up. There was a traffic jam between sectors 18 and 19, and there was going to be a brief scheduled power outage in their area in about 10 minutes' time. Nothing to worry about. The power outage was bang on schedule. Street lights blinked out one by one, then after about a minute, they blinked back on. One of them seemed to be taking its sweet time, and she stared at it, hypnotized by its incessant blinking. Blink, 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 pause. Blink, 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 blink. Pitar yawned. What a life. She checked the monitors. There was Nebish droning on. 0110110011110. After a few minutes of listening to zeros and ones for the billionth time, she checked her phone. Another scheduled power outage? Geez, what was going on at the power plant? She would sue, but it was all run by robots, and they had no legal status. The lights again went out. Again they flicked back on. Again Pitar yawned. Holy flav, said one of the tech guys. Pitar heard nothing. For the first time in 3 years, there were no zeros, no ones. Had Nebish died? Was it over? He's gone, said the tech guy. Pitar's blood ran cold. Impossible! Impossible! She ran out of the van. In the street, a thousand other investigators and lawyers, all staring at the apartment. Then up at the sky, as a sleek black vessel soared into the upper atmosphere. She blinked a few times. Her brain and an idea were having a serious fight right now. The tape! Run back the tape! The last 5 minutes, she shouted, diving back into the van. They looked at the footage. Same old Nebish and his binary droning. What's he saying? Run it, she said. The tech guy punched in the numbers and the computer spat something out. Something meaningful this time. Not a recipe. Not a sitcom. A 753-character code. It had to be the code to the force field. He was signaling someone, whispered Pitar. He knew they were coming. One of the tech guys, starting to tremble, raised his hand. What? Barked Pitar. What would be the point of giving out the code? He couldn't have known there was anyone coming. Remember, the Faraday cage. No signal gets in or out except... He paused. Except through us, said Pitar. Run the outside footage back, from the power cut. There it was. The blinking of that streetlight. She quickly encoded it to binary. One blink for zero, two for one. Run it, she screamed. The code said, Howdy, pard. Here to bust you out. Breath and shuttle cloaked over your ranch. Need the code, pard. She began tearing the van apart, ripping up the seats, the monitors, the fabric of the roof. That's where she found a tiny bugging device and a tiny cable that led out into the street. She followed it, pulling it up as she went. It had been glued down to the pavement, tucked into the cracks. It wended its way across the busy road to a shop, a small market. There was a neon sign over the door. It said simply, Bodega. Pitar dropped the cable and fell to her knees. Snide 4 was ruined, and the worst and therefore best hacker in the galaxy had just teamed up with one of the most wanted men alive. The end.
Oh man. That was really a good one. That was really good.
Thank
you. Holy shit.
That's some great fucking work setting that up. That was glorious.
That was really good. Holy fuck. Hats off.
Thank you.
It was a magnificent little short. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, me too. Man, I was so deeply engrossed.
That was one of the best you've done, I think.
Really? I didn't think you guys would like it. I thought it was going to be a bit too...
I thought that was fucking weird. Perfect. It was so good.
Oh, that was
especially like the bodega thing at the end. The sign above
that.
The market.
Yeah.
That was a nice touch.
Thank you.
That was really good. Oh, shit.
Man.
That's great. Okay, well, that's all we got time for this week on the Trifles Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I did.
I had a great time.
I didn't. Yeah, I did.
Thank you to Sips.
Thanks.
Thanks, and me, and of course, Putu.
Thank you, Putu.
And my name.
And Putu.
See you next time.
Don't move my letters.
All right, goodbye. Bye.